You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 443. Lack of money always means a surplus of creativity. In the best case, Joe Carnahan.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, guys, you are in for a major treat today. We have on the show writer-director Joe Carnahan. Now, Joe bursted onto the scene in 1998 at the Sundance Film Festival, where his debut $7,000 feature film, Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane, blew the audiences out of their seats. If you're familiar with Joe's other works, you will understand that his kinetic form of directing, which is so unique to him, has been there since the very beginning with his first $7,000 short film. He followed that up with the film Narc, starring Ray Liotta, and then blew everybody out of the water with Smoking Aces, which was such a big hit for Universal that they greenlit a feature for it right away. And he followed those up with films like The A-Team, The Gray, Stretch, and his most recent Boss Level with Frank Grillo and Mel Gibson. And if that wasn't enough, he's not only written everything he's directed, but he also does a couple of screenplays on the side, like Pride and Glory, Death Wish, and the most recent Bad Boys for Life, which grossed almost $500 million worldwide. Now, Joe and I had an absolute ball talking shop in this episode. Our conversation ranges from what the realities of this business is, his journeys with Tom Cruise and walking off of Mission Impossible 3, how that affected him, his career, what he's done in his career, meeting some unscrupulous people along the way. I know that's surprising to hear in Hollywood, and so, so much more. So I want you to sit back, relax, and get ready to go on a ride with Joe Carnahan. I'd like to welcome the show, Joe Carnahan, man. How you doing, Joe?
I'm good, Alex. How you doing?
I'm good, brother. I'm good, man. Thank you so much for doing this, man. I've been a fan of yours, man, for a while, bro. Since
a long time. I've been in the business 74 years, so you know you got a lot of.
I mean, so when you worked with Orson, how was that?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is back. You know, Joe Cotton and I were close, and I mean, dude, Jesus.
So I mean,
I only feel like I've been in business that long, dude. You know?
No, dude. I feel you 110%. As we were talking about earlier, we feel a lot of things more as we get older.
Oh, buddy. By the way, if you could stand the treachery in this town, it ages you anyway. It's like being president, you know?
Yeah.
Right? Bush goes gray. Obama goes gray. Trump somehow just goes more orange. It wasn't gray. It was a weird, you know.
It was a weird thing.
I know. You spent so much time. It's lucky we're not, you know, broken down, decrepit.
So I want to start you off, man. I want to ask you, why did you want to become a director? What kind of got you started in what made you think of jumping into this ridiculous business?
You know, dude, I just wasn't suited, I think, to do anything else. I mean, I don't think I was smart enough to be a stockbroker or school teacher or good looking enough to be a movie star or rock star. So it's like, you know, you just start going, okay, what can I do? And I had a love of writing at a very young age. My mom gave me this very kind of, I think, very potent love of books. And I just took that up. And so I was, you know, 13, 14, I was writing a lot. I was writing short stories. And, you know, this is like kind of, I shouldn't say pre-computer because we were always playing like either Atari or Intellivision or whatever. But we really, my mom made a really concerted effort to kind of push us into that. So, you know, and I'd always loved films. And so I started, you know, when I was 18, I wrote my first screenplay and it was garbage. But I had written a letter at the time. I think Shane Black had written Lethal Weapon. And I wrote him a letter as a kind of aspiring on a long shot of a moonshot chance he would ever respond. And he did. He actually wrote me back because I was doing the tacky. Hey, let me get a hold of your agent at UTA or whatever the hell it was. And he was kind enough to basically say, listen, send your script. You know, if time permits, I'll certainly read it. And it was just dog shit. It was a cool idea, but it was a dog shit script. And then I just kept going. I just thought like, this is a war of attrition. And right. I wrote another one and another one and another one and another one. And I try to tell these kind of fledgling screenwriters, if you think you're going to knock out of the park on the first one or the second one, you're nuts. It almost never happens. You know,
right.
You've got to teach yourself the craft like anything else. You know, you want to be a great sprinter, you get in the blocks and you sprint every day over and over and over again. And I thought to me, because I never thought I was that particularly good, I thought you make up in the margins with hustle. And that's so, and I still think that way, dude. I still go about it the same way I've always gone about it, which is if you want something done, you got to do it yourself because ultimately you're the only one that's going to care that much. So, and dude, listen, I consider myself fortunate to still be doing it, to be honest with you, brother. It's like, it is a brutal, ugly, at times merciless, and it's also the greatest job in the world, right? So, you know this, dude. It's like, you know, when it's rewards, it's dynamite, you know?
Oh, and it's the highs and the lows, man. Isn't it the highs and the highs are the highest of the highs and the lows are just brutal.
Oh, brutal. And I've experienced all those things in great quantity. So, you know, I just kept going, man. And I got a job. I got fired. I got fired from this place because I had to kind of piecemeal my college education together. So I didn't get my bachelor's until I was almost 25 years old. So I remember I was working at this place and I wouldn't help this guy shoot like basically softcore porn in the warehouse that he had at night. He had a video production services place and he wanted to use these strippers from this local strip club and shoot softcore porn. I thought I can't do that, man. Nothing against pornography. I'm a giant fan of longstanding, but I'm talking about, I was like, no. And I thought he was kind of sleazy. And so he fired me on a Friday. And so I wouldn't roll over to the next pay period.
Of course.
That's what a stand-up guy, this is who he was. And I went home panicked. My then wife was pregnant with our daughter, who's now 25 years old. I was absolutely freaked out. And I remember this local TV station used to do their own 30-second trailers for movies. So I remember I wrote one for Road Warrior, Aliens, and Poltergeist. I wrote three little 30-second spots. Purely doing it on a lark because I was like, I didn't know what the hell else to do. I wasn't fit to do. I wasn't going to go, oh, let me go get a teaching job or a TA job or something. So I took them. I didn't even know what the hell it was called. I just called. Who does the you know, I called the station. Oh, that's our promotions department. And the guy's name was Andy Crittenden. And I took him down on Friday. I dropped them off. I drove back to my place, my little shitty one-bedroom place in Sacramento. I'm sitting there going, you know, what the hell am I going to do? Around 7 o'clock, the phone rings, and it's Andy Crittenden. And he says, I read your stuff. Why don't you come down Monday? I have a promotions producer spot that's just come available. You could take the test for the job. And there I met my dear friend, Kevin Hale, who right now is sitting about a half mile away cutting cop shop for me and cut boss level. So we've been friends that long. We both started a promotions department at this little crummy TV station in Sacramento, but it was dynamite, brother. It gave me education, every form of production. Mm-hmm. And it was invaluable in that way. So that's really where I got, where the jump was. I made Blood Guts.
Yeah. We're going to get into Blood Guts in a second. I also, worked in promos back in the day as an editor but not nearly as cool as your stuff, like Road Warrior stuff. I was doing Matlock and, like promos for Matlock and, Andy Griffith, Andy Griffith show stuff. Like that's what I did back in the day. Oh yeah, dude. Yeah.
They were brutal. Yeah.
Hundreds of them. Now I need to ask you, man.
Oh bro. Yeah.
I need to ask you. So can you tell me the story behind your script Karate Writer?
Oh God. Dude. Okay. So there's a guy, I shouldn't be cruel. I don't want to be cruel. His name's Ron Marchini. He's basically like, if there was a poor man's Chuck Norris, he's that poor man's Chuck Norris, right? So he's like, you know, it's terrible to say, but it was these really cheesy, karate movies. And I had written this kind of what I thought was this really cool. I called it like Stray Trigger, some jerk off title, like in the, you know, early 90s that you did. And it was this love triangle between this criminal, this kind of hardened killer, a cop and a psychologist. They all kind of were interrelated. And I thought, oh, this will be cool. And I wound up selling it to him for like $3,000, $2,000, this script, whatever the hell it was, which to me was a lot of dough. True. Right. And then I got very kind of, you know, uptight about what they were going to do with it. Long and distinguished career being a fucking pain in the ass and not being able to just say, hey, dude, you know, which we'll get to, bro, where I finally said, yeah, I'm just gonna take the money, guys, knock yourselves out. But it was, I don't believe they ever shot it. They did I think they called it Omega Cop.
The whole movie's on YouTube. So you can watch the whole movie on YouTube.
Shit?
It's called Karate Raider, but within the description is your movie, but the title in the movie is different than Karate Raider. So I actually scanned through it. I didn't sit and watch the entire thing because of it was genius.
No, I would recommend that.
It's actually on some show. It literally just got put up like 4 days ago. Like, what are the chances?
Are you kidding me?
I just looked. I was like,
what? This, hey. Lucky me, right, bro? Wow, how great is that?
I was scanning through it. I'm like, well, man, we all got to start somewhere. We all got that project.
Yeah, I mean, dude, it feels like one of those horrible relationships you have. You're like, yeah, she was good. He was kind of nuts, and I don't like to talk about it. That's really what it was.
But
yeah, she tried to stab me in the shower. It didn't really work out.
But she's right. but a heart of gold. Heart of gold.
Okay, all right. Hey, sweet girl. Don't get me wrong. Sweet gal.
sweet girl.
Yeah, right. So, until she came through the vinyl with that machete, everything else was, you know, it was great, man. It was great. Good time.
She was going to be the one. She was going to be the one.
She was the one. And you know, I'm sure she'll find somebody nice. To be sure. She'll work out.
I wanted to bring that up because I always like going deep back into filmmakers and cinematographers and screenwriters, right. early work, because that's where the meat of those stories are. Because, you know, we could talk about all of the successes, but I always like, I want filmmakers listening to understand that everybody starts somewhere. Everyone's got to eat some crow. Everyone's going to get punched in the face all the time. So that's why I bring it up.
Also, do you think, these are the necessary kind of doldrums and kind of the B tier, C tier, D tier, Z tier things you have to do to get going and get your name out there and try to make a living at this. It's not easy. And again, you know, dude, you and I came of age again where you got, you know, you think about you being in this business, being a poster for 20 years, you've seen technology. I mean, this goddamn phone does more, this and iTunes does more than I ever had access to at a full-blown production facility with a DVE and every other thing, you know, with a flame and all these things. We go, oh my God, this is so amazing. You know, your phone will do that stuff with filters and like, it's crazy. So I always tell people, there's no excuse for you to not make something. You know, you see extraordinary things made by amateur filmmakers. It's like, but again, I think the cream will still rise to the top, you know?
Yeah, no question.
And dude, you need wherever the hell you're starting out, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, whatever you're doing. I got friends of mine that make these fantastic Instagram shows, you know, it's like, but they're still out there trying to grind it out to get the quote unquote shot. And they don't come easy. And again, a lot of times you just got to be willing to get, you know, your balls beaten like a birthday pinata. And you know,
what a great line.
And that is what it comes down to is your, you know, how resilient are you?
Mm-hmm.
How tough are you? And how much do you want to take getting smashed in the face time and time and time again? Because that's really what it's going to require, and not take the shit personally. And it's only now, dude, that I no longer take it personally, and I'm inured to kind of the treachery. You're not going to show me anything new in terms of taking a, you know, 6 inches of a 9-inch steel tempered blade between my spinal column. I get it. I mean, it's like, okay, I didn't, you know, there was money or something on the table and you decided to go that way. So, okay, I'm not shocked.
It's
you can't get angry about it.
Right. And it's the thing I always say is shrapnel. Like, you've got shrapnel. I've got shrapnel. Like, you know, it could be different shrapnel. And that's, and I promise you, it is different shrapnel, but
I love that, dude. You're right. That analogy is great. You got shrapnel.
You got shrapnel. And that's why, like, you know, you were talking to me early on that you saw that video that I did, that episode I did about, you know, the truth about independent filmmaking and all, and how, why they don't make money and things like that. And it's just this raw kind of shrapnel is the best word I can use, because it's a war, and you're going to get hit. And that's why everything I do is because I want to help filmmakers not avoid, but understand that the punch is coming and how to,
exactly.
You're going to get hit. You're going to get hit.
Brother, you can't do them a greater. That's the greatest service you can do to filmmakers. Like, if you think that you're going to run that gauntlet and not get knocked on your ass and get that kind of ammonia taste in the back of your throat and you really get the shit kicked, you know, you're going to taste it. You are, man, that bitter, coppery, it's coming. And I think too many people make this false arrangement / agreement with themselves that, oh yeah, but not me. I'm going to cow coast. And I've certainly seen it. And then I've seen those same people, dude, get dropped in the stratosphere and land on their head. And it's like, it's just gonna, you're not going to be able to sit it out. I don't care how good, I don't care what cloud you think you're cruising on. You're going to get knocked. And by the way, you should want that. And you should want it. And it doesn't matter, dude. It happens all the time. It's happened to me. It's happened to me multiple times. And right. It's, again, how you shake it off and keep going. And the great thing is, brothers, you know, it's like, you've been doing this as long as you've been doing it. It's like, we don't age like athletes. You know, we're not a blown rotator cuff away from, like, that's it. You get better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm better. I'm better in my 50s than I ever was in my 30s or 40s. Across the board better. So anybody that doesn't, you know, Raymond Carver didn't publish his first short story until he was 52 years old. So it's like, you can be one of the most prolific kind of American short story writers. It's like, there is always room to, and it's age proof. It shouldn't mean, oh, I got to be this young upstart kid. It's like, those experiences don't necessarily move me. The way the experiences of people that have lived life do. So yeah, man, it's never too late, and you can always improve. And I love that about the craft, you know?
Absolutely, man. Now you had your first feature, was called Bullets, Guts, Blood and Octane, arguably the one of the best titles, that come out of the 90s. I have to say,
I hope so. Maybe not the best film to come on tonight. So no, but no. Again, brother, going back to this is a movie that I was in. We made for like $7,000. It was designed to kickstart everything. I think, unfortunately, we got caught in the massive wake that Tarantino had created, and no one could do a crime genre film of any kind without the immediate supposition being, well, it's Tarantino, as though that genre never existed prior to Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. So that always kind of rankled me, because there's used cars, Bob Zemeckis in there, there's Glengarry Glen Ross, there's all these kind of influence, Moore Leonard, there's all that shit. But watching it now as a much older guy, I think the writing is great, and it's funny, and it's goofy, and it's amateur, but it works. And it's like, I never thought it got a fair shake. And I think I've had one of those careers, dude, I think it's always been and you know, you sit here and go, well, I never got my due. I never got my due. It's not about getting your due. I just always think I was misunderstood in certain ways. And it took movies like The Gray to go, oh, the guy, I guess the guy is serious about, oh, you know, it's like, I just don't like to do the same shit. You know what I mean? And it's like, and I think sometimes that, because it's not, I've always said this, I'm not interested in making movies. I don't give a shit if they say anything about me in 50 years. You know, it's like, I want to make stuff I enjoy and stuff that, you know, that for whatever it is, but I'm certainly not curating a career. You know, I'm like, I think about it very much. You know, I came from, you know, a lower middle class, you know, middle Michigan kind of, and you're lucky to be, hey, you pulling a paycheck doing this. I mean, my mother says to me, well, honey, at least I'm glad you got your degree. It's like, Mom, I think I'm okay. I think I'm all right now.
You make this film, and from what I understand, you shot it on 16 and edited it on video. Yeah. So I'm assuming you edited it on 3/4, or did you do?
No, I edited on the M2, the Panasonic M2, which was the cheap.
Wow.
Oh, I know, dude. The horror. I know, bro. I know, bro. You look like you just saw a photo.
Because I actually did some research, and is it true that you edited on the Pinnacle DVE?
No, brother. I edited on, it was, yeah, the Fast, the Pinnacle, the Fast. It was the precursor to the Avid. But I'll tell you this, dude, to me, to this day, that interface is still better than Avid's. It just is. Because you could drag and drop. You could do all this, which you can on Avid. But to me, and again, I'm cutting right now with Kevin. I've cut in every one of my films. I've cut sequences or scenes, or I've done, because I cut this movie, Blood and Guts. I cut it all myself. So, you know, I still understand. I love editing. To me, is like writing, right? It has that same kind of effect. But you know, the ease of use on that was so great. And so, but it was, I don't even know if they're still in business, dude. It's like,
no,
if they're still making.
I think they are. Like when I
5-to-1 compression rates and it's like, dude, it was just, and all, brother, listen, when you just think this is the way people are going to see the movie, you're not, oh, fuck, black, make it black and white. I don't care. Who gives a shit? You know, and again, dude, the theory being creatively that shit ceases to be shit if it's moving fast enough. They're not going to realize they made it for no money. The performances are, you know, a bunch of kids, blah, blah, blah. So it was, you just had this kind of devil may care attitude about the editorial thing. And then they go, oh, now back to film. Oh my God. So I had to go, everything had to go back to be transferred. And then I had to have an IP. Then I have an IN. Then we had the negative cutter. And then we had, oh my check. It was like, oh my God. And this is back, dude, photochemically. This is how you had to color films. You didn't have the Da Vinci. You didn't have couldn't go into like, what's your LUT? What the fuck? You know, it's like, there's too much cyan in this, there's too much magenta. And, you know, but you did it. You went and screened reels. So it was a totally foreign, but yet I'm glad because I got the tail end of that. And it was great education that I wouldn't have had. Like over the last, you know, film school, we're still cutting on a cam. It's like, oh, okay, you know, but that's gone, bro. That's like,
no, that's nuts.
But I'm glad I experienced it. Yeah. No,
And the other thing I heard from you is about that, the story about Blood and Guts was that you actually used all the TV station you were working at, all their gear and all of their lights and anything you can grab a help without their kind of permission, or they frowned upon it.
The guy I mentioned earlier, Andy Crittenden, gave me permission. Then he took a job at Fox, and then it was one of those. Well, I ask for forgiveness and permission now because I'm not going to go back to the GM of the station. And then literally that Saturday as we're shooting, the GM of the station walks into the conference room where we all are sequestered shooting this scene and basically said, well, I hope somebody's making money on this. But he never shut me down. Elliot Trushinsky, who's a really lovely guy. And years later, dude, years later, I'd done Smoking Aces and never. I was at this really kind of nice Mexican restaurant in Sacramento, and my kids were still up there. And I saw him and his family having dinner, and I bought him all dinner. He had no idea what the hell was going on. And he came over, and he was so lovely. You know, but I'm like, hey, dude, that was a brilliant thing you did for me. And you never shut it down. You never you could have, and you didn't. So I was dancing between raindrops, dude, on that particular thing. But yeah, dude, it was all, brother, M2 machines, digitized. Would tell my then wife on a Friday, I'll see you Monday morning, or Monday night. And I would work through and bring a change of clothes. I slept under the editing console on 1-inch stacked reels. That's how I'd sleep. And just cut, dude, just to get this goddamn thing done. Because I thought, if not now, when? And if not now, never. You know what I mean? It's like, it was one of those deals.
And then So you do this film for $8,000, right? Then you get into Sundance in the midnight screening, right?
Yeah.
So you get into Sundance, and I see the trailer, which is so brilliant. That trailer that you edited for like Four Blood Guts is like, how did an $8,000 movie get into Sundance? And you just boom, boom, boom. And I was like, man,
we did all our own marketing, dude. We did all this kind of guerrilla marketing. Yeah. And by the way, dude, you know, like my buddy, like Kevin Hale, like looked like he's smuggling heroin through the airport and we're selling kids to the gypsy. I mean, it's crazy, dude. We went way over the top in these little like kind of vignettes, but it was like those kind of that vibe was what we needed to have happen. And it was because we were just lucky to get anything, dude. It was like, mm-hmm. you know, bro, the idea that it was to play theatrically was nuts. So that in and of itself was just a gigantic victory for us. And everything else after that was great. I thought the first screening at the library at Sundance was kind of a disaster. It was fine. But I thought the second screening, which was in, God, where was that little area where like it was the Holiday Village Cinema, I think. Mm-hmm. That one was a bunch of snowboarders and they loved the movie. It was a very different crowd. It wasn't the film crowd. It wasn't the cinese. It was kind of like the guys just coming off the slopes of the snowboard. They loved it. And so, but it was, dude, it was the Sundance experience. It was like, yeah, that was every, at that time, brother, and I don't know if it's the same now because Sundance is a very different place. That was the goal, man. That was the Sundance Film Festival was it. You know, you got there and you were on your way. I think that was the first time my mother saw Robert Redford in a restaurant. She's like, oh, I think maybe, you know, you could make something of this, honey. It's like, yeah, Mom. I think, you know, we'll see. You know, it's like, That's the goal, Mom. I don't want to move furniture the rest of my life. So, yeah.
And the funny thing is, like, my dad still doesn't know what the hell I do. Like, I took him on set one day on a spot. Yeah, they're like, do you make money? You're obviously doing well enough to own a home in Los Angeles. So whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
You have a family. You have two girls you're taking care of. And yes, right. You don't seem to be engaging in high-end bank robbery. And right? So yeah, dude, whatever you're doing, keep doing it, kid.
Yeah, because that generation,
the less I know, the better.
it's so funny because that generation is all about like, if you don't work in a factory, if you don't like bust your ass for 9 to 5, it's not a job.
Oh, dude, it's not a job. Like, what are you doing? You know, like
writing.
I don't understand it.
Writing.
Wait, what? Writing. Write what?
Yeah. I write. I don't get paid to write.
Grillo's got this great. Grillo's got this great story about he and his dad standing on the patio of his place in the Palisades, and his dad's looking. He's like, "You got this from acting?" got this beautiful kind of sprawling pad in Pacific Palisades. It's like his dad from acting. You got this? No. I've been knocking off 7-Elevens. Yes, from acting. I got this. It's like, but dude, it's a generational thing, brother.
It is. And I think the generation coming up behind us, like our daughters and they are so aware of everything. Like they know about, you know, if being online, and they know about followers, and they know about building content, and they are so much. They're just exposed to stuff that we weren't exposed to.
And I think that's the thing, dude, is to try for me at least to slow that down, because I'm so terrified that overload is very real.
You know,
it's very real and it's scary and it's pervasive.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. And I try to do everything I can, but then they see what I do and they're just like,
that's exciting.
They googled me the other day and they're like, Daddy, like people know who you are. I'm like, look, man, I am nobody. Right. In the grand scheme of the world, I am nobody. but yeah, there's a few people I'm not Obama. Like I can walk the street. Like everybody in the world knows who.
Dude, think about this, bro. Think about if you couldn't. That's always because I've watched that happen to friends of mine. Listen, I watched it happen to Chris Pine. I watched it happen to Bradley Cooper. I watched it literally happen to them in real time where they couldn't be themselves anymore. And like they had to deal with being constantly bombarded and constantly inundated with requests for autographs, requests for pictures. I remember sitting in Dorchester having dinner with Bradley Cooper. And this woman comes up and says, can I get your picture? And she says, oh, honey, he's trying to be cool. I'm right in the middle of a meal. She goes, when are you going to be done? And just kind of posted up there. I'm like, see, I couldn't do, I don't have the time. I'm gonna put this fucking fork in your hand. How about that? And then you know, it's like, are you out of here? Get the fuck away from the table. Have some respect.
I know, dude. It's insane. But you're right.
Privacy and someone's, you know, like, come on, man. You know, it's just ridiculous.
But, it's insane. Yeah, dude.
I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't. I get recognized once a blue moon. It flips me out, dude. It flips me out.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, when I was talking to Albert Hughes. I was talking to him the other day on our show, and he was telling me, he's like, dude, I was at Planet Fitness, and some dude walked up to me. He's like, hey, man, I got a script. Like, he's on the treadmill, and he's like, I'm in the middle of working out. He's like, all right, and he waited. He's like, I'll wait till you're done. And he just stood there next to him.
Dude,
and Albert was like,
I just say, man, go through your CAA. I can't, you know, you got to go through the agency. I can't. Because if I read one page and somehow I put, you know, a guy walks into a store, I ripped your script off. It's like, yeah, okay, you know, you can't.
But it's insane. Dude.
And
it's
insane. I get it, brother. I get the hustle, man. I do. I get it.
But there's a right way to do it. Like, look, man, I literally got the word hustle on my shirt and on my hat. My whole brand is about hustle, but I've been yelling and screaming from the top of the mountain. I'm like, look, guys, there's a way to do this. And there's a way to approach people, and there's a way to do that hustle and respect it, as opposed to like calling somebody at their house or dropping off a package at their house. Yeah. There's ways of doing it. And
dude, it's creepy. I don't want you coming near Mike. Don't do that. It's like, that's not for public consumption anyway. I don't want you to know where the fuck I live. It's like, who, you know, come on, man. Any more than you will want me to know where you live. It's like, it's creepy, right? It's like, so. And I get it, dude. Listen, part of me is always, it's always cut with this kind of sympathy of, all right, I get it, man. You know, it's like, you know, it's brutal. It's trying to get your stuff. But the idea that I'm just going to jump right into your screenplay and change your life. And it's like, and I'll say, how many scripts have you read? First script, write another one. What are you waiting on? Don't sit around, you know, the coffee shop waiting for this one to take flight. Write another one and work. And you got to work them, you know, you got to multitask these things. You got to keep them all, you know, keep all of them moving and shaking in a different, you have to, I still have to, everybody does. And you should. I like that experience. I'm used to it. You know what I mean? And it's comforting to me, as opposed to just having stuff kind of float in and here you go.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know,
so your next film was a bit of an upgrade from the $8,000, which was Narc. I remember there's just a lot of stuff swirling around Narc. I remember when Narc came out, and because it was then, and during that time, we were still like, it was on the tail end of the whole Sundance kind of craze, which was when Tarantino and Rodriguez and Smith and Linkletter and Spike and Singleton, all these guys were coming up. So you were on the tail end of that, like in 98 with Octane, and then Narc came out. So exploded onto the scene. I remember people were like talking about it left and right, like, oh my God, this is like revelation. This is the next big thing. And I will get to that part, but man, I heard other stories about like the making of it and the money behind it and a lot of craziness. Can you go into that a little bit?
Dude, it was one of those, and this is the way that a lot of these independent films are financed. They're very, anytime there's millions of dollars, you're going to have people in there that want to siphon off a certain amount of that. And it's like the skim in a casino, you know, it just is. And if you think that you're dealing with, you know, these honorable sorts across the board, you're dead wrong. You know, you're not. You know, you're dealing oftentimes. I mean, one of the guys on there was like literally gone to prison. I think at one point he was like trying to reach out for me from like, you know, like the Baker Denver Row cell block, whatever the hell it was. It was like, wait, what? This guy's. So it was very, and I remember, you know, we'd say to the, you know, the it's like, hey, man, we didn't get the wire. And it's like, okay, we'll send it. We just got to find the number, and then they call us back and go, oh, we can't remember which bank we made the wire with. And I'm like, guys, you're doing the adult version of My Dog Ate My Homework. This shit isn't funny. You know, we've got a crew we have to pay, and you know, we're in Toronto in like the dead of winter, And I remember walking onto a set one day, this kind of really run-down little one-bedroom apartment. I remember walking, and there's the production manager, and I turned the corner, I hear him say, "I don't know when you're going to get paid again. I don't know if you're ever going to get paid again." And this is 7 a.m., you know, before we shot any, you know. And I just, listen, I just decided the best way to deal with the situation was just to take the bull by the horns. I said, "Guys, listen, we're dealing with disreputable people and people that are kind of sleazy. And you have mortgages and you have, you know, car payments and you have kids to feed. I can't tell you how to do that. If you don't, if the money's not here by the end of the day, you should walk." I would. And I think for whatever that was worth, it galvanized them for a moment. And they kind of, they understood our plight and they hung in there. But dude, you know, it was a movie that could have very easily kind of disappeared and just been this cool little, you know, but I remember going to the Eccles Theater, which is still the best screening I've ever had of a movie. And it just went through the roof. And I remember right after that, they took myself and Ray and Jason Patrick up to the main street of Park City and put us on CNN Live. It was great, right? And I thought, okay, that was something happened. And then, you know, kind of post that, coming back, Lionsgate, Tom Ortenberg, who I'd made three films with, who picked up Blood Guts, it started this whole, there's like, you know, the Bel Air screening circuit is basically a euphemism for rich people that have theaters in their homes. And so I started meeting all my heroes, Dustin Hoffman. And I remember like just meeting everybody, all these great, you know. And one night I'm having dinner with Ortenberg and Jason Patrick. We look up and Warren Beatty's standing there. He just came down to like Banderas on Barrington and Wilshire just to hang out and talk about the movie. And it was just this crazy. And then, you know, I get the call that, you know, Tom Cruise has seen the film and he wants to meet you. And I go to Cruise Wagner. I'll never forget it, dude. And I'm in the conference room and I didn't realize the main entrance had a little latch style lock and it was locked. And suddenly the door just starts trembling to like shaking. And then just pulls open, the lock flies off and there's Tom Cruise. And we start talking. He goes, he was dating Penelope Cruz at the time. And he goes, "Listen, she had a family member that had, she walked out of the movie. She covered her eyes and left the film." And he goes, "I knew it was as good as I thought, I knew it was great. And it was a great movie right there because she couldn't bear it." And then, dude, and you know, listen, he got that film a tremendous amount of notoriety and attention, and really rescued it from being, it could have just been this little $3 million indie that, you know, was cool and disappeared. And he really made it kind of bigger than the sum of its parts. And for that, I'll always be grateful to him for doing that. You know?
Yeah, and that's not something that Tom does very often. Like he hasn't like shepherded an indie or, you know, an independent or a very, you know, much lower budget non-studio film like that. I don't remember. He might have done a couple here and there, but I don't remember him doing that. It's not what he does.
Yeah, no, he was really, it was something else, man. It was something else to kind of, I don't think I was aware of how extraordinary that was, you know. Yeah. For me to experience, and only now as a much older guy, I go, "You dumbass." You know, it's like, "You idiot, yeah, like you 31-year-old jerk off kid, didn't really know what the fuck was going on." It's like, you know, by the way, please shut up. You know what, if I could time travel, if I had Doc Brown and a fucking DeLorean, I go back and slap the shit out of myself. Shut the fuck up. Not everybody needs to know what's on your mind, bro. Shut up and lose 25 pounds. That's what I'd say to myself. You know?
Cause I'm feeling it now. You fat.
Yeah, you motherfucker. Yeah, everything's your pain in the ass, dude. Nobody likes you. Shut the fuck up. You know. No, it was remarkable, brother. It was one of those like, just kind of amazing moments in time. And you know, the movie came out. The movie did what it did. I think it was obviously successful insofar as. It was one of those movies that got, listen, Paramount put Oscar money behind it and mm-hmm. did a campaign for Ray, did a campaign for the screenplay, did a campaign. You know, it was great, dude. It was really something else, you know?
So then from that film, Tom hires you to do Mission Impossible 3, which in hindsight, and I'm just thinking this myself, like if Kevin Feige knocks on my door tomorrow and says, "I want you, Alex, to direct the next Avengers and here's $200 million. I would take the meeting, but yeah. Right. you take the meeting, but
you're going to get coffee. Right, at least there's that, bro. You're gonna get a free cup of coffee.
So you free cup of coffee or a bottle of water at least in the water bottle tour.
Right. That's the extraction. Right.
But the point is, you know, I mean, at this age, I think we can really, like, you know, this I don't want to overextend myself. I haven't give me a $10 million movie. Give me a fifth. You jumped. Yeah, dramatically.
It was, and I also think in my hubris, and I think, listen, the script that Danny Gilroy and I wrote, I still think is a knockout, and I think there's elements of it that work their way into those later Mission Impossible films, being disavowed, having to go to ground. That was all stuff we covered in MI3. So I think it was, again, dude, my kind of naivete and my inexperience in thinking that I could really kind of shepherd this in a way that I retain kind of the auteur's vantage, which was never fucking going to happen, right? And not just plug myself into a process that, take the ride, kid. You're going to make a lot of money, you know? And I think, listen, this is what you realize too. I think now with these big franchises, I don't think they want filmmakers, brother, so much. I don't. I think they want someone that's had kind of a ready hit and kind of an indie darling or whatever, and then they plug them into this kind of gigantic franchise. But it is a largely plug and play scenario. It's like, you know, my wife jumps horses, she's an equestrian, and, you know, they have these $1 million, she calls them push button horses. You put anybody on that horse and that horse is going to take them through a course and they're going to look great, but that's not riding. You know what I mean? And kind of, it's a little bit the analogy I would think of now. It's like, you're not that there's anything wrong with these films. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that process, man, it's preordained and it's predestined. And mm-hmm. and you're gonna have to understand that. And I didn't. And I was a pain in the ass. And I thought that I was fighting a good fight. And I've always told the story. I think, listen, I quit a week before they were gonna probably sack my ass. You know, I was out. And listen, do I have regrets about it? I don't, dude, because it was my process and it was my journey, as stupid as that sounds. And it was something I had to experience on my own. And I had to live and die by that decision. So, you know, I thought my career was over, and it was one of those, listen, it's one of those gut check moments in your life. It's like, how good are you? Can you get yourself out of this? Are you going to be able to make another movie? And so, I have the greatest stories about that time, you know, and they're anecdotal now, dude. And that's what it's meant to be. And not, I don't have an ounce of rancor. I don't have an ounce back then. I was like, motherfucker, brother. No, listen, man, Tom gave my tiny little movie a gigantic birth, man. He really did. And really helped me out a lot and really propelled my career in ways that I'm probably still not 100% cognizant of or aware of or appreciate. So, you know, you got to take that for what it's worth, dude. And it was, you're right, going from a $3 million movie to a $180 million movie, probably not the most astute career move. You know what I mean? Like,
you got to chillax a bit, man, because you're – and I gotta imagine, man, that the town, like you walking away from such a high-profile star and project where there's probably 1,000 directors – in line waiting to do a job like that, and you just like, you know what, I'm out. I'm assuming that gave the town gave a bad tip. Like, who is this guy? What is he really about? Like, it must have been a struggle for you to even just get the next thing going again. I'd imagine.
It was, and you know, it's like, I'll never forget talking to, it's a great story. Alan Worthman was a lawyer, he's a lovely guy, and I was trying to get my daughter into Gallatin at the Tisch School at NYU. I was talking to Alan, he goes, Joe, I got to tell you, I got to thank you, man. You gave my client his feature career. I go, oh, who's your client? He goes, J.J. Abrams. Glad I could help. No, glad I could help. Wow. Well, with great affection, I adore J.J. He's a mensch. He's one of the great guys in this town. He really is.
I've heard that from people who work with him.
Incredibly underrated, I think, as a film, but one of the most lovely human beings. I love him. So I say that, but I just think to myself, oh, you fucking idiot. You know, you idiot. You had to open your mouth, didn't you? You had to say something. You couldn't shut the fuck up. You had to say something. But that's
you though, man. That's your brand, if you will, as an artist. I mean, from what I've seen as a fan, that makes all the sense in the world, like that you were that dude.
I guess, bro. I don't think I've ever, I certainly don't take myself that seriously. I take the work very serious, and I think right. overly serious sometimes. And you have to kind of know, you know, you gotta, you know, spare your powder when you can. You know, don't die on every hill. You know, it's like you, and that's I think I that those are you know, hard fought lessons and hard learned lessons, but they're lessons nonetheless. So, you know, I'm thankful that I've, and you know, dude, listen, there's guys out there and guys I won't name and kind of, you know, the filmmakers that can plug into those situations and understand those ebbs and flows and so on and so forth. And it's like, and they have these tremendous, they make these big studio movies and franchises and sequels and so on and so forth. And I always say, like, I want their money. I don't want the career, but I want the money. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right. So yeah, yeah. Me.
I don't want the career. I think my career is very cool and weird and offbeat, and it mirrors, I think, who I am. And so I like that because I think it has its own personality. But I'd be lying and say, yeah, shit, man, I'll take your money. But those guys also have the gear changes and the understanding and the nuances and the subtleties of dealing with, you know, the film exec and the studio chief and the thing that I think I possess now, but I certainly didn't at the time. And again, you know, and there's great, that kind of savvy and that business acumen is something that I had to really work for and took a long time to develop. And some of those guys just have it, dude. They know how to surf those breaks. And I admire that. You know?
Yeah. I was talking to an agent once, and they said, you know, when I'm looking for a director client is I need an artist, a businessman, and a politician. And they have to have all three yeah. things. It's so, so, so true. Now from.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah, you don't. And without those things, brother, you are going to be left lacking. You just are. You are.
Now, you did one of the Hire. I love that Hire series that for BMW.
Yeah. Yeah.
How was that, man?
Oh, it was brilliant. It was Tony Scott. Like I got signed at RSA, uh-huh. Ridley & Sons Company. They were so generous and so loving and so welcoming. And at the time it was like Tony Scott, John Woo, and who the fuck is that clown? Because the people that done it prior were Fincher, Frankenheimer, right. Blanket. Who did Chungking Express?
Guy Ritchie for the Star.
Guy Ritchie, right? So there was this great kind of band of notables, and then there was, you know, me bringing up the rear, like, hey, yeah, it's me, you know. So it was, but it was, you know, I got Clive Owen, Eve Marie Abraham. I got to work with Mauro Fiore for the first time. It was one of those, like, you know, it felt like fantasy baseball camp. It's like, go ahead, you put the pinstripes on and you can take batting practice. Like, wow, I'm here. So it was, you know, Don Cheadle. It's like, it was a blast, man. Robert Patrick, Ray Liotta. I got to work with these great, wonderful, wonderful people. And it was right after Narcs. It was prior to Mission Impossible. So I'd done that just after in the kind of the rush of Narc. And had a commercial career, which I never anticipated ever having, which was great, dude. It was amazing.
It is awesome. Now, the thing I've always loved about your filmmaking in general is that it has a very specific energy. There is right. a kinetic energy to your films, some more, some less. So yeah. like, The Gray has a different kind of that energy. Right. But then I think the ultimate expression, and please correct me, the ultimate expression of the Carnahan's kinetic energy is Smoking Aces. Like it is this.
I think it was until Boss Level.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was going to say Boss Level, yeah. Boss Level. It looks very, it has that thing, but the colors, the amazing, ridiculous cast you had in Smoking Aces, the kinetic energy. I was remembering, like, when I saw it in the theater, it was just like I felt abused after I finished watching it. Like I felt physically assaulted right. by the visuals of it. It was visceral, and yeah. It was so visceral that, like, but they launched with two, at least another two sequels, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It just kept
universal. Yeah, yeah.
It did so
buddy,
well.
Yeah, buddy PJ Pesh directed one of them. Yeah, it was one of those again, dude. It was one of those. I think it was born out of my frustration about Mission Impossible 3 and this idea that I wanted to do something that was just kind of almost like it's a mad world, right? This kind of, you know, kind of zany, over the top kind of assault on a penthouse with this kind of, you know, and this weird magician kind of illusionist at the center of it. And this idea of interlapping stories, overlapping stories that were just kind of, again, my kind of sense of humor and my sense of irony and my sense of the sardonic and all that weird shit. And it was also, dude, one of those movies. I always felt that it was the outgoing regime at Universal, kind of their hand grenade in the incoming regime, because it was like it was working title. So I had the imprimatur of, like, you know, of Eric Fellner and Tim Bevan, and that they're really kind of high end, very British, very very studied, very kind of wonderful filmography that they had put together, and so they couldn't really say no. But the idea that you could do that movie now, Alex, that you could have the main character, or not even the main character, the main character by default because everybody else is dead, unplug everything in this kind of nihilistic, and it's funny, it's like the movie that I'm doing right now, Cop Shop, I say it's absolute first cousin of Smoking Aces, but it's not nihilistic. It actually has this great heart in its core. And it's probably just me getting older and softer and not needing to kind of, you know, do the, you know, so you would never make that film now in a traditional studio ever, dude. They would never let you get away with that. So I always thought that we got one over on everybody because it was such a downer ending, you know, more or less. It wasn't wasn't this uplifting kind of like the guy just fucking unplugs everything and sits there and, you know, disarms himself and throws his FBI credentials on the ground. That's that. It's like, and they let it go. It never happened now, dude. Ever. You know?
Well, Smoking Aces would never get made today. Like,
you
just...
You know what's crazy? Of all the movies I've made, the one that's been the bonanza in residuals is Smoking Aces. Hands down, dude. I've made more money after the fact on that movie than any other film. The A-Team, any of them. Like, that movie is so weirdly... And I get friends of mine going, dude, every time that fucking thing's on, I watch it. And I have movies like that. Like, I don't care where Jaws is, where Heat is, where, you know, Road Warrior, where Aliens, I'm watching. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm in. Whatever it is, I'm in. And Predator, it's like, I've got, oh, shit, man. Oh, they're going to, you know, they're going to kill Billy, you know, Sonny. It's like, he's dead. Like, I'm in there. So it's one of those, the kind of the repeatability and the playability, I think, is always something that
I've done.
And visually, I think Morrow really was edgy in the way to shot that thing. And to this day, I look at it and go, man, that thing looks like it shot last week, you know. And that's the great, that it has a timeless quality to it. I love, you know.
And the cut.
Doesn't feel dated at all.
And the cut was insane. The cut was beautiful.
Right. So again, it's just one of those movies, dude, that. And it was also misunderstood, dude. Same thing. It was like that movie was really for me about the war in Iraq. It was this kind of maniacal, insane levels of violence being leveled toward forces that we weren't quite, you know, weapons of mass destruction. Who are we fighting? Wait a minute. These guys weren't behind, you know, 9/11. These guys were. Oh, no, they weren't. We went in Afghanistan. So it was this nutty kind of, and then at the end, the government decided, well, we cut a better deal and fuck you. And that's really what it was about. And I just think it was like, oh, it's just fucking crazy. I'll never forget. David Denby wrote the most awful review of the film, but it was so entertaining. I love the review. It was such. If you're gonna get trashed by a really good writer. Get trashed by a really good critic. Not like Willy Waffle. Get trashed by Anthony Lane or, you know what I mean, A.O. Scott, or get trashed by a really good writer. But it was. And again, I just think to this day, dude, there's so many fans of that movie after the fact. Yeah. It's just around. And it's weird. It just plays, you know?
Now, you've experienced, and I want everyone listening to hear it from you. Have you encountered any fake or scumbaggy kind of people in your filmmaking path, sir?
Never, bro. What? What?
No.
Mary Poppins, like Doris Day. Pillows of fluff and goodness. What do you mean, dude? No. Oh, Jesus. I mean, dude, at one point in my life, I couldn't swing a dead cat without hitting a scumbag. It's like, you know, it's like you're just, it's, you know, Alex. But again, you can either let that dissuade you and you can become a cynic, a dick, which I've certainly had my moments. Or you could say, all right, this is a temporary, necessary evil, sometimes unnecessary evil, but you're stuck anyway. And, you know, listen, dude, I can't listen. This is the way that I've chosen to make movies, which is largely outside the studio system. Really, Smoke and Aces and The A-Team are the only studio films I've made, you know. You know, Boss Level isn't, you know, it's become a Hulu film. A Cop Shop is STX, but that's still like, that's still an indie film. It wasn't financed in a traditional, you know, kind of studio model. So, you know, you really can't, this is the path that I've chosen to go down. So I can't, you know, bitch and moan about,
No, of course.
You know what I mean? But yeah, dude, there are tons of them. They're knife fighters and pimps and whores and you know, they'll slice you fucking, you know, appetite to windpipe. It's like, that's what they do. So, you know,
and they'll smile doing it. And I always, the whole point of what I do is to tell the reality of what the business is with hope. Like my mantra for filmmakers is like, follow your dream, but don't be an idiot.
Don't be an idiot. And by the way, dude, listen, you know, like the great, I don't know if you're aware of that great Katzenberg quote about, you know, in this town, people live to see you fail. And if you die in the process, it's that much better. That's Hollywood.
What a great line.
In this town, people live to see you fail. And if you die in the process, it's that much better. There you go.
What a great line.
One of the great maverick kind of studio. You know what I mean? A guy that's gone down swinging. And has had, you know, spectacular success. So, and he's abso-fucking-lutely right.
Yeah. You know, there's no question.
That count is correct.
Now, another thing a lot of people don't understand, it's such a reality, man, is rejection in Hollywood and rejection on your filmmaking path. And there is, again, illusions of people when they receive, and directors when they get to a certain level, that they just, like, you just, you know, Joe Carnahan could just walk into Universal and get whatever he wants made. And I always tell people, dude, Spielberg couldn't get Lincoln financed. Scorsese couldn't get Silence financed for 20 years.
Yeah, dude, this is the struggle. I mean, listen, you say there's like five guys, Jim Cameron, Spielberg, Chris Nolan, Michael Bay, I'm trying to get kind of, that are kind of like, okay, what do you want to do? But even then, it's like, no, we're not going to let you do that. You know, no, you can't do that.
Well, no, with Cameron. Cameron, they let Cameron do whatever.
Cameron, whatever. Cameron wants to shoot interstellar space toilets. He can shoot, you know, it's about a fungi that come, they'll give him the money to do that, right? right?
But it's the truth. I always tell people, like, listen, there's literally one human being on the planet that could have made Avatar. Nolan couldn't make that. Nobody else could make Avatar. You can't walk into a studio, ask, I'm going to need about $250 million to develop technology for an IP that's not existing, and we're going to figure it out.
How are you shooting today? We're not shooting today. Get out of here. And they go, okay, well, we're not going to bother you. We're not here to bother you.
Right. Oh, no stars. And no major stars.
Yeah, and no major stars. Right.
Who does that? No one.
Jim Cameron, you know? It's like, but that's Jim Cameron, right? And also, like, you know, like, guys talk about Cameron, it's like, he's also the most unpretentious. It's like, yeah, he's got these things. He has his way of working, and it's singular, and you got to get on that thing. But at the same time, it's like, hey, Jim, you hungry? Here's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Okay, great. You know, can I get a lift? Yeah, we just jump in the back of that truck. You know, okay, cool. He's not, you know what I mean? He's not precious. And I think that's what is the key to it, is like, yeah, he takes that shit. He's deadly serious about that. And I think, and I get that, man. It's like, I always tell people, it's like, hey, don't worry, guys. It's only forever. It's only forever. This fucking moment's only forever. Right. And by the way, they don't talk about, oh, that's okay. That's okay. People don't discuss in 50 years. That's okay is bullshit. We have this moment in time right now. It's only forever, you know, and that's it. Right. It's like, fuck. This is it, man. This is what they're going to see from now until the end of time. So goddamn take a beat and do it right. And I think that's what Cameron is exceedingly brilliant at. Like, I'm going to do it this way. Listen, watch Aliens, dude. It's as good now as it was in 1986.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's as great now as it's ever. It is a crackerjack sci-fi war thriller that's just dynamite, you know. And he took everything that Ridley did and just weaponized it and just shot it with steroids. And it's like, and it, you know what I mean? All the beats are there. He just made him expansive. But you're right. It's that guy. That guy and that guy alone can get it done.
No, not Spielberg.
You're right.
Nobody else on the planet. Right. And you can, and I think someone asked him that, like, how does it feel to be like one of the only people in the world to be able to do something like that. Because there's like five guys, like you just listed off a bunch of them, that will get that kind of budget. And again, those kind of budgets are dependent on things. But Cameron's, right, it's not dependent on anything. it's insane.
No, it's not. Exactly. It's just, it's what Jim wants to do, you know, and whatever whim that he's going to follow. That's amazing, dude. That's amazing. You know, but I would want that responsibility. I was like, man, because
500 million
Cameron can't fuck off and go do a $5 million film. So
yeah, he can't.
There's a different kind of freedom in that. He can't do that because expectations are too great. You know, I don't think that is not freedom. That's a set of expectations that you must meet. You know, it's like Chris Nolan go do Memento again. I think that's a fucking genius film. It's a brilliant movie. Can he go do Memento again? You know, it's like, well, it's Chris Nolan. You know, it's like, right. So I worry that that's like, and I want to see him do that again. I want to see him do Memento or Following. Those are great movies, you know,
No, I didn't mean to cut you off, but like that brings me to your film Stretch, because that was exactly what that was, because you've been playing in the semi studio and studio and like $20 million, 15, like you were at a higher level, and then you're like, screw it, I want to make Stretch for, I think you wanted 3 to 5, I think it was like 3 to 5, right?
Yeah, it was. I think it was just under $5 million movie. Yeah,
right. So,
which to me is one of the most talented guys I've ever worked with, and mm-hmm. is a joy and funny as shit, and I adored it, and I loved working on the film. But it was Jason Blum, and it was one of those things. It's like, listen, and again, Jason's business model. You know, we're gonna make 10 of these fuckers, and maybe one of them punches through. But and again, even that I was antagonistic about. You know, it was like, and because I thought, well, you know, we're gonna do, you know, we should do this. You should want to do. That doesn't mean it's going to fit the studio calculus, man, with what they want to release and so on. So it doesn't matter. I love that little movie. And it's just like, and I had a blast making it. I was making The Blacklist at the same time. So it was kind of like, okay, cool, man. I'll do the big, you know, kind of fuck off TV pilot and series. And I'm going to go make this little indie, you know, because that piqued my interest. And I thought it was fun. I mean, I literally, Alex, messed around with like a couple weeks ago. I was like, shit, man, I may shoot an entire film on an iPhone and cut it on iMovie just to see if I could do it. You know what I mean? Like make a feature on an iPhone, and not like Soderbergh made Unsane, but they still had $50,000 Panasonic, Panavision lenses on those. You know what I mean? You still got like the G series. I mean, that's a beautiful piece of glass, dude. So
oh, it is.
You
know, it is.
So, but literally shoot it on an iPhone and say, okay, what can you do on an iPhone and iMovie? How good are you? You know what I mean? Or are you just full of shit? And literally say, it's like the Dogma thing, you know, back in the day with Benjamin, all those guys, like the Dogma 95 thing. It's like, you can only use an iPhone. You can only use iMovie. You have to use all the effects and all the music that are contained within iMovie. And you got to make a feature. That to me is exciting. That's fucking cool. Now I'll probably never do it. Talk a lot of shit.
I did my last feature I did for about $3,000-$4,000, and it was shot on a pocket camera, 1080p pocket camera, and I just ran to Sundance and shot an entire movie completely guerrilla at Sundance about three filmmakers trying to sell their movie at Sundance, and the ridiculousness of what filmmakers are at their core, the egocentric, Yeah, and that's what I did. I shot it in 4 days. And I came back. It was so much fun. Like, I've worked on much bigger budget stuff. And yeah. I just, like, yeah. I was like, you know what? I want to see if I can do it. And I want to leave something behind as a call, like a love letter to filmmakers. And I just want to see
that,
and see what I could do. And, dude, because it was so little budget, I was like, I don't know if I got a movie. Like, we shot 36 hours. Like, it was a 36 hours over for 4 days. And I, on the plane back, everyone was like, do you have something? I'm like, I don't know. I didn't have time to just know.
Got to get in there. Yeah, dude.
And I just went in there.
That's fun, brother. That's fun. Now, wait, so much fun. Done? Are you still messing with it? Is it done?
Oh, no, dude. It's been released already. Yeah, it world premiered at Rain Dance and stuff. I'll send you a link.
I want to see it, dude. What's it called, bro? I want to see it. Where can I see it?
On the Corner of Ego and Desire.
Oh, that's great. What a great title. You see these, I'm like, guys, what in the fuck are you talking about? Do you know how lucky you are to be doing this goddamn line? Are you out of your fucking mind?
I'm, t- like, I'm t- just get up and do it. Like my, like I always tell filmmakers, and I did it also as a case study to show filmmakers. I'm like, I don't look, you don't need an Alexa. You don't have $50,000 glass. You don't need all this stuff. If you keep the budget super low, do whatever the hell you want. Now, if you would have given me $250,000 to make that movie, I would probably said no, because that story and that audience doesn't justify that budget. And I, unless it was money that I could throw away. So you have to be physically responsible, but at three or four grand,
who gives a shit?
Do whatever the hell you want, and people love it. And it's been like, and within my community, people really,
dynamite, it's great. Brother.
It's, but that's the
dynamite.
But that kind of goes to your point.
Decide to go do it. I'm just gonna go do it.
By the way, that was 2 months, and about 6 to 8 weeks prior to Sundance. Like me and my buddy, just like, hey, we've got $1 million suite that we're staying in on Main Street. Shoot, let's go shoot a movie. All right. And then I just kind of like, let's do this. It was great. That freedom. And I've talked to other filmmakers about it too. And they just like, look at me. They're like, man, what was that freedom like? Like I had three crew members. I had the DP. Right. I had the sound guy. I had myself. And I had the three actors who I never met. I only Skyped them. And I casted them from New York and flew them in. So I first met them. So it was completely... And it was kind of like a Curb Your Enthusiasm, more improv, like very structured story, but the dialogue was improvised. And I was just...
Which is the Mike Lee, Ken Loach, you know, kind of way of the...
Swansburg, Mark Duplass, that whole...
Yeah, exactly, dude, exactly. Right. That's dynamite. Like that's... Yeah, and it's like, and if you get away from that stuff, dude, and you know, you stop being able to do that. I remember Billy Friedkin, who's a huge fan of Dark, loved it, right? Saying to me, man, Joe, I wish I could make a movie like that again. I wish I could just make a... I said, Billy, why can't you? Why can't you? And I understand because the expectations were, well, it's William Friedkin and it's got to be X. And I think when you get... That's when you start to crawl up your own ass if you think you can't do that stuff. And that's why I always admire guys like Soderbergh who just says, fuck it, man. I'm just going to subvert this because I want to and because it's fun to me and it's interesting, you know, and I'm going to give you any number of looks and I don't really care how these things are quantified because every once in a while I'll remind you how great I am by doing fucking Oceans, like doing studio movies better than anybody knows how to do a studio movie and then fucking turn around doing Magic Mike and make it a mint off, you know, like, it's like, you know what I mean? So it's like, that to me is a career worth really examining and studying.
Oh,
and
I love him. I love
you know what I mean? He's dynamite.
And he was the one, and he launched Sundance. He's the one who launched it.
He did.
Sex Lies.
The first thing he thought as a filmmaker do was his Sex Lies and videotape, the compendium that had the screenplay and his kind of diary. And it was compulsive. It was absolute must read for me to kind of get my head around, you know, what the indie film scene was like. And it was massively helpful. That stuff. That's what you really learn, I think, about yourself is like, I just did this little thing. Like I literally took Lauren Green's song Ringo and put my two daughters, at the time they were like five and they lip synced the whole song. And I did it, and I had more fun doing that than I've fucking done, you know, literally. I had more fun doing that and got a bigger kick out of that than I have, like, and it was just us messing around, you know?
And that's what Robert Rodriguez does that all the time with his kids in the back. Robert's Robert, dude. But did you see
that way?
I'm assuming you've seen Mandalorian.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. Now back to the show.
You know what, dude? I haven't watched the second season of Mandalorian. I was slow to get to it because I think I was kind of burned out on Star Wars for a minute.
All right. So the episode that Robert did, I think episode 5, was it's so Robert, first of all. But he later in the behind the scenes, he actually, before he went to shoot it, he didn't have time to storyboard it. So he went in the backyard with stormtrooper figures and shot and did a kind of a rip-o-matic of the scene. He takes it to John Favreau and Dave Filoni, and he goes, yeah, here's what I want to do. And Dave just like halfway through, he goes, hold on, can you stop for a second? Did you just go in your backyard and shoot this with like Star Wars action figures? And Robert's like, yeah, that's all I had. I didn't have time to do it properly. He's like, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life.
No pretense. Robert's a filmmaker. He's gonna go out and do his thing. You know, it's like he did it. I remember seeing he had done this. I mean, God, this is years ago now. with Rose McGowan. He had done
Grindhouse.
But he'd shown me a sizzle reel that he just shot with her behind the scenes, the lady in the blue dress. It was a Sin City thing. With her with blonde hair and blue eyes in the rain. And it was like, whoa. And he said, yeah, just he shot it in an afternoon as a proof of concept. I'm like, dude, on his computer. You know, it's just like he's got that. And then grabs a guitar and you know, crank out like the score. I mean, it's fucking
it's insane.
I'm in awe, dude. You know,
it's insane, dude.
It's just another level of cool that I'm not capable of, you know?
It's absolutely insane, dude.
Bananas. It's just bananas, dude. It really is.
Dude, so dude, honestly, The Gray, your film The Gray, dude, is arguably I think love that film. And they marketed it so beautifully, like, oh, yeah, wait a minute. Liam Neeson is gonna strap on some bottles and fight.
Fight a fucking wolf.
Fight a fucking wolf. That was as low, as high concept as you could get.
Yeah, dude. And it was one of those things too. It's like, I remember we had like, you know, like a 2-hour and 25-minute, mediation on life and death with occasional wolf attacks. It became an 1-hour and 45-minute wolf attack with occasional mediations on life. And it was, you know what I mean? We changed the polarity of that entire movie because we understood like this is what you need to give the audience. But that ending was always, it was never a sore spot for us. Like, listen, the guy's made a choice how he's going to die. And that's all you need to see. After that, it's superfluous. We don't need to see the fight because we had a fight. Dude. We cut a whole fight. And I just was never a fan of it. And you see a little in one of the flashbacks, the wolf snapping in his face. That was from the fight. And we use that as kind of a nightmare to jar him out of the sleep. But it was like, it was more, and not because, you know, K&B, Nicotero, and Howard Berger, those guys made these great kind of, you know, the snapping puppet heads and the alpha. But it was one of those, it's weird, dude, because I feel like I'll spend the rest of my career chasing what it felt like to make that movie, which was, we were having this adventure and we just happened to be making a movie at the same time. You know, but we were up in like, in Smithers, British Columbia, in the deep, deep snow. We got blown off the mountain twice. I was snow blind. You don't know what that's like, dude, where your eyes just constantly buzz focused because you don't have any sense of foreground, midground, background. Mm-hmm. And then I stayed out there, out where we were in this cabin. And I'm telling you, dude, at 6 o'clock at night, it's pitch black. And it is a quiet like you will never experience in your life, that quiet. Which must sound like what it would sound like when no one's coming for you. You're dead out here. You know what I mean? It was like, thank God, you know, but like it was a remarkable experience, dude. It was very much about, you know, where I was. Like people ask me, it's like, it's funny. Like you get asked about films and whatever. And I'm always at a loss because I go, I don't really know that guy. I knew that guy. I was that guy. I don't know what the fuck that guy was thinking. So I'm not really. I could give you an approximation of what it was about to me, but I've heard theories about the film that are far more interesting and intriguing and smarter than anything I've ever come up with. You know what I mean? So, you know, those are things you just let it go. It's like it's out there. It's gonna speak to different people in different ways, and you have to just allow those translations to take place because who are you to say what the fuck it should mean? You know, I know what it means to me. I know what it's about.
I mean.
For me.
I mean, obviously Die Hard is the greatest Christmas movie of all time. Now, that wasn't the intention, but it has become that.
Right. It has become that. And again, dude, it's you're whatever those things are, whatever those, you know, I've had people send me pictures, they tattoo the poem on their arm. I'm like, Jesus Christ, guys. Wow. You know, it's like, which is dynamite, but it's a little, it's also, it's like, you know, it's like, it's a bit overkill, but I get it, man. I've had people say, listen, my dad was dying during that time and that movie meant a lot to us.
Oh, man.
You know, it's like, wow, it's amazing, dude. So again, that's for it to do anything that approaches that kind of, I'm so thrilled, dude, that it did that. And again, you can't, it's like a kid you sent off to college and he winds up, being successful and you're kind of just in awe of it, but that's his, those all movies have their own existence. You release them and then they do their thing and then they grow and mature and take on qualities that you could have never foreseen. And that's such a lovely thing about this, about making films that they really evolve, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Wonderful ways, you know?
Now you, a lot of people don't know this, but you also write everything you do.
Pretty much
you have a hand in everything you do. Yeah. And you also just wrote like one of this year's big or last year's biggest movies, Bad Boys. The new Bad. Anytime I see your name come up on a screen, dude, I'm like, oh, this is gonna be fun. Like I'm always like when I saw the Blacklist, I'm like, oh, this, okay, right. I got, right. Okay, Joe's right. doing this. That's it. It's gonna be fun.
You're in for a good time, dude. You're in for a good time.
You're good. This is gonna be fun. I don't care what it is. It's gonna be interesting. It's gonna be fun. Let's rock
right,
and roll.
Right.
And that's the brand that you've cultivated over the course of your career. And for guys like me who kind of grew up at similar vintages as far as age is concerned, and seeing what you've done, I'm like, okay. That's Joe. So I get what you're going to do. So what is your writing process, dude? Because you're prolific as a writer. I mean, you write a lot.
Well, dude, I right now it's funny, man. You know, I'm not in the zone. I haven't been in the zone for a while because I haven't really been writing. It takes me a day or two. Like I'll usually go somewhere and just get so I'm alone and I can focus. And it'll be a day or so of me just tinkering around and dicking around until I start to get that thing moving. And then once it's moving, it's great. But it's like Juggernaut, the comic book character. Once he starts going in one direction, he's just going to keep going. It's going to run through shit. And that's kind of how it is. Like I have to keep that momentum up. But listen, sometimes, you know, I'll write a page in a day. Sometimes I write 10 pages. It just depends. It's my most favorite thing to do therapeutically and creatively is to write still. Because I just take great comfort in it because I can really, and I've been doing it a long time, dude. And you've been doing it for 30 years, you start to get good at it, or you understand the kind of the ebbs and flows of structure and character and dialogue and so on. So it's a lot of, I don't do like vomit drafts. I don't just jam. I take my time and I write refined stuff and then I rewrite and then I refine and then I rewrite and find more. So I never just, plow something out there for kind of general consumption. It's got to be kind of, I put a lot of fucking, a lot of heat on it, a lot of eyes on it, a lot of TLC. Cause I just think that's what, but it is a process to get into that mode of thought. You know what I mean? And you think, cause I'm editing right now, it's kind of the companion piece is writing. It's really not. It is a writing process. It's just not actual writing. So when you're asking me this now, if I was writing, I'd have a much more fluid. I would seem a lot more confident. But right now, I'm like, I don't know what's going on.
I don't know if I'll ever write again. I don't know. When I write my books or things like that, you get down that road and you just start writing and writing and writing and writing and writing. Yeah. And then you stop and you're just like, can I start this up again? Like
I have to stay in it. I have to really stay in it.
Yeah.
If I more than 2 days, 3 days without writing, it's hard to get back in. And I'll find myself waking up at odd hours to go back and keep moving. And again, sometimes these are little Pyrrhic victories. Sometimes they're big kind of swaths of stuff that you cover. But it is in the best of scenarios. It is not excruciating, but it can be. And there's scripts I've written, dude, that my script for Death Wish is still the best screenplay I've ever written. I think it's my best screenplay because it was a total pain to kind of the ideas of the way that the Gray was about being, this kind of macho bravado and what we're expected to be as men and so on. So Death Wish is very much that. But it's like, am I core a coward? If faced with these things? So I wrote this kind of pain to that pain and this emergent killer in this guy where you realize, oh, you're a doctor, but that's the fraud. You're actually a killer. That's who you are. This other thing is, you're Mr. Hyde masquerading as Dr. Jekyll, but you've always been Mr. Hyde. So it was, I had to like sit and watch that thing be essayed in a way that I did not agree with. It was nothing like my screenplay. Right. Mm-hmm. But I took the dough. And so you shut the fuck up. And I did. And not that you can't say, it's like, hey man, it doesn't matter what the hell I think of it. Mine was very, very different, but it was one of those things where I pull it out, dude, now and then I go, boy, you ain't that guy, but dude, at the same time, I remember writing it on scotch and probably cocaine. You know what I mean? Like, I think I remember doing a little bit of blow, but like, But it was, but that fuel is false. And again, I've learned that now because I'm basically kind of sober at this point in my life. And, yeah. and I feel more energized and more capable and more willing. So I don't think that these are things that could just be accessed. And I think, again, we all have that romantic kind of, you know, Hemingway and Steinbeck and Peckinpah and all these guys were like hard drinkers and Bukowski and yeah, you know, and they died young and they died horribly, you know, so,
yeah, they didn't die quietly in their sleep surrounded by loved ones.
You know, cirrhosis of the liver, Hemingway, both barrels of an over under shotgun, you know, so like, yeah, he, you know, they went out in a very, very grandiose fashion. So you romanticize that. And I realize it's not really where it is. So now, and I also think, dude, there's a reticence on my part to jump back into something original because I know there's the high watermark. Can we get back there and be that? Because I still write for people that read. I don't write bullshit scene breaks. I write, you know, and that's what Death Wish was. You know, the first 25 pages are a standard screenplay. The minute that guy gets attacked, the entire thing shifts to first person. So there's no more scene breaks. So I'll write entire pages of just asterisks because he's knocked out. And then it goes into large font. And then half the page is empty. And then, you know what I mean? Like I was doing, it was kind of like art to me, you know? Nice. And I thought, God damn, like, I don't know if I ever get back to that, you know? And that's kind of that's what's exciting to me. It's like, fuck, I gotta figure out a way to top that. I gotta figure out a way to get, you know, write something that's, I think is better. You know what I mean? And that's, you know what I mean? That, and that's kind of it's a great, dude, it's a great, that's a great expression of energy, you know.
Absolutely.
You know.
Now there was one script of yours that was fairly famous that didn't get made. I know it's something that you always wanted to make, Killing Pablo.
Yes.
Which was a script, but yeah. I heard that someone literally, because screenwriters are always scared of people stealing their work and doing something with it. You, from what I understand, someone literally took the cover off of the script. Oh, put their name
on. I'll tell you who was fucking names. Yeah, this guy literally was he went and got wined and dined by the Colombian government because I've been down there a couple times, and he literally just tore the cover page off and said, "Written by Bob Yari," and that was the and I saw the screenplay. There it was, and I thought, wow. And again, we go back to, you know, the treachery you experience in this business. It's like, I don't know where the guy is now. He might be, who knows what he's doing. He's probably maybe selling snow cones. I don't know what the hell he's doing, but you know, it was, you know. What would have shocked and awed me back then and with just disgust and contempt is like, yeah, you know, he made a run at it, man. He tried to sell an angle. But yeah, was basically using that to kind of, you know, get his way with the Colombian government, which is just insane to me, dude. But
not the smartest thing to do.
Not when you can track it. And by the way, the script had been around for a little bit and it had gotten a lot of good attention. And so, you know, but then Jose Padilla and Wagner Moura, and they did, you know, they do that great, you know, thing with Narcos. And it's like, it couldn't have been a better team to tell that story. So I was bummed out, but my screenplay was really Bowden's book. It was really the manhunt for Escobar, not so much. And I think that's the problem I had finding someone that wanted to play Escobar, because Javier Bardem was going to do it for a while. And I think they wanted that Robin Hood like romantic angle of Pablo, and he was a fucking absolute bloodless killer. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I love his family. We all do. You know, you could be a homicidal maniac and still love your kids. And that's what he was. And I think I was more interested in that, in the run up and how insane he almost tipped over a democracy at the time. 62 million people in Colombia. It's like this guy almost ran the table, you know, and that mm-hmm. was fascinating to me. And it was because of some very brave people, Colombian officials that stood against that shit. Not unlike we just experienced it in a very different way that basically mm-hmm. stemmed the tide of that becoming a narco state, you know. But yeah, man, it was, you know, again, one of those screenplays is like, man, God damn it, you know.
But there's always, we always have that story or that film or that thing that we couldn't get made. Yeah. And it's not even the lack. And that's the thing I want people to understand. It's not the lack of quality. It's not the lack that if it's a good script or if it's a marketable script, sometimes the stars just don't align.
They don't align. You know, I've had it happen, dude. Listen, White Jazz, which is a sequel to LA Confidential. You know, my brother and I wrote the absolute shit out of that script. And we were dude, literally like a year ago on the 1-inch line with Netflix, right, to go do that.
Oh.
And it just didn't, you know, it just didn't happen. And I remember there was like the British version of Toshin Books reached out to me and said, do you mind sending us your materials on YGS? We want to include it in a compendium called the 20 Greatest Movies You'll Never See. I'm like, you go fuck yourselves. One, no, I'm not sending you. Wait. I'm supposed to be honored or flattered? Oh, wow, you like it that much? You want to include it in your book of movies you'll never fucking get made? No. How about no? How about fuck off? Jesus, man.
Can you imagine if they called Kubrick up? I'm like, can you send me your notes on Napoleon?
On Napoleon? Yeah. It's like, how about no? Ever. Fuck you. You know? Live to fight another day, dude. You live to fight another day, you know?
So, dude, so boss level, dude.
Yes.
It's insane, dude. Like the trailer looks insane. Basically this is what this is my analogy of it. It's Groundhog's Day, which is the first kind of like time loop film I can remember. Yeah. Groundhog's Day meets Smoking Aces.
Die Hard. It's Die Hard and Groundhog's Day. It really is. It's like it's just again, dude, it's just one of those movies that everything it tried to do or we tried to do and then it just worked. And it's funny as shit. There's complete kind of there's this young actress Selena Low who plays Guan Yin.
Yeah,
this trailer just absolutely steals the movie. And then you've got Frank Grillo in this kind of really
so good.
You know, I said, dude, watch. It's funny. We watched Singing in the Rain. So watch Gene Kelly. Watch the way he moves. Watch Harrison Ford. Watch his relationship with the cameraman. Watch how he understands. Where he's and you're setting about making this very deliberate kind of big Hollywood kind of spectacle action movie comedy that's just absolutely fucking bonkers that they never would have let me do this stuff, dude, because it's nuts. But when I tell you, dude, it's one of the funniest. It's just laugh out loud funny. It just works. And again, I'm incredibly fortunate that it found, because it's been, you know, 2 years of struggle and hardship and so on to get it out finally. And God bless the powers that be at Hulu. They saw it and responded to it the way that we wanted them to. And so, yeah, man, it's nuts.
When's it come out?
March 5th on Hulu, which I think is, I don't know what day that is, but.
I can't wait, dude. It's so good.
It's so much fun. It really is. It's really, and like I said, it's emblematic of me and my personality. It's just
it's
scatological. Then it gets serious. Then it goes back to being, you know, kind of it's great, and he's great in it. You know,
now
he really is. You know, now, Mel's great. Naomi's great. No,
yeah, Mel. I mean, Mel's Mel, dude. And I'm looking forward to seeing. I'm looking forward to seeing Lethal Weapon five. Yes, five.
Yeah,
I want to see what they do with those two.
I know.
And Donner's doing it.
Donner's doing it. He said, I guess the script is actually really good. I love that Dick Donner's doing 90.
I was going to say, how old is he? Like, that's like, how old is he?
89, 90 years old. But by the way, Clint's still doing it. Clint's 90. So,
but Clint, I mean,
that's how, Alex, that's how I want to go out. Just wheel. I don't care if I'm in a fucking wheelbarrow. If I'm just a head. And like a small intestine, just wheel me around. Let me say, cut in action.
Well,
it's like
Hitchcock. It's like Hitchcock was literally being rolled around on a wheelchair.
He probably get rolled around when he's like 40. I mean, that's, you know, it's not, you know.
To be
like,
fair, to be fair,
yeah, right. But yeah, dude, I you know, it's like, you know, I think it was like reading an article years and years and years ago when David Lean was trying to make Nostromo and he couldn't get insured because he was too old. It always broke my heart. I'm like, fucking David. You can't figure out how to put David Lean on set, you know, or like when Altman had to basically have P.T. Anderson like kind of understudy him on I forget the movie, but those stories are always kind of like I just want to be vibrant enough and still mentally acute and cogent enough that I can understand what
the physical and physical.
If I'm not, just don't take my mind. Just don't strip me of my, you know what I mean, like. Don't have me start talking to my boogers, please. Like, I don't want to do that. I have deep discussions with. You know what I mean? Please just spare me that, you know?
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests, bro. What is the one thing you wish you could tell your younger self?
Oh, God. I think I went into it, dude. But I would just say to him, hey, dude, pace yourself. Don't talk so much. You don't have to entertain everybody. Sometimes silence is golden. And not everybody needs to know your opinion at every moment, and just know enough to know when you don't need to do anything. Just let it be, you know, and chill. Patience, my son. Patience. That's what I would tell me. So,
what advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
You got to outwork everybody, man. You really
Amen.
Do. You should
Amen,
be hitting, you know, man. Listen, it's like, you know, like they used to talk about like Vijay Singh as a golfer. You go out and hit 1,000 balls and everybody else will hit 100. You should be hitting 1,000 balls. You should be out there, you know, perfecting and honing your craft and getting better and better and better and learning all the tricks of the trade. And in addition to learning those, learn the shortcuts, learn the areas you can save yourself time. You know, like you're saying, brother, and understand everybody's job. Know what the colorist does. Know what the sound mixer does. Know what the production designer does. Know what the sound designer does. Know these various jobs. Know the DP. Know lenses. Not that you have to know these things in, you know, in encyclopedic kind of fervor like Kubrick or Spielberg that know those things like the specific like ground glass, how that thing is gonna. That's a whole other level of freakish genius. But get yourself educated and don't take a goddamn thing for granted, because you can't take anything for granted. Not now, man. Maybe not ever, but certainly not now. There's a lot of competition out there and it's stiff. And I wouldn't want to be coming up right now when you're trying to like bust through, when you got guys like Damien Chazelle doing what he's doing, which I think is wunderkind like, and, you know, so it's a tough road to hoe for sure.
Yeah, the world's changing so effing rapidly, man. It's just like so ridiculous. Our business has changed so dramatically in the last year.
Dude. Yeah, man.
But like literally,
anyway, like you said in that prior podcast, like we may never recover, and it's certainly not going to look the way it's looked in the past. And I think that's, you know what, Alex, that's all right, dude. That's okay. Like,
but it didn't look the same way since like when VHS showed up and DVD showed up and then streaming showed up. Like, it always color showed up, sound showed up. Like, it's always it's just happening so much faster now.
I mean, bro, listen, I got one of those Oculus Quests. Put that on and play Beat Saber and tell me that you're not gonna have to fuck with VR at some point. Play Super Hot and tell me you're not gonna have to fuck with VR. How do you compete with that? It's a $400 unit. It's cooler than any video game I've ever owned in my, you know, like, are you kidding me? It's like, so you know, you have to do these things, and you can't get mired in tradition. You can't get mired in, well, it's got to be this way, or I got to make a studio film. Listen, when I was young, if you had a 2-picture deal in Universal, you were hot shit. That's indentured servitude, basically. You're just giving your ideas to, you're just giving your IP away to, you know, it's like, don't do that. Or if you're going to do it the way Todd Phillips does it. And that guy, it's like, yeah, let me make it for, you know, let me make my little fee, and then I'm going to take a gigantic piece of your bag in success. And that's a guy playing a game at a very, very high level, you know. So there are ways, there's certainly ways to game the system. And even with Chris Nolan, like, listen, whatever your feelings about Tenet, right? You liked it, you didn't like it, whatever. The fact that guy's still taking those kind of swings at the plate to try to put the ball fucking 500 feet from home plate, you got to have those guys, man. That's exciting to me. So there's all these areas of progress and of evolution. And mm-hmm. it's like you got to find them, you got to make them your own, and you got to extend your own game, whatever that may be.
And the hardest question of all, 3 of your favorite films of all time.
That's not that difficult, dude. Raging Bull.
Raging Bull?
Raging Bull. Raiders of the Lost Ark. And there's a film called Harakiri from Masaki Kobayashi from 1963, Seppuku, that's basically, I think, is the best samurai film. And it may Kurosawa strike me dead from beyond. But like, it's one of those movies that just, I just adored it. And I just saw it. I just showed it to my DP in Atlanta. We had like a, we put like a big, like a home theater in the basement of this place so we could watch movies. And it's just one of those epically brilliant slow burns that you just don't see anymore. I love that film.
Dude, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. Like, I could talk, we could talk for another like 2 or 3 hours. Yeah, we could do anytime you want to come back. You're always welcome to.
You know, if I got a DUI or I'm in trouble, bro, I got to come on. You know, you got to make a little room for me, bro. You know.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Get myself out of trouble.
My goal is now to get you to go out and make a $5,000 or $10,000 film. That's.
I'm telling you right now. We got to talk offline, bro. I don't think that's a bad idea. I don't, and I think there's some. I think it's ballsier to go do that than it is to go out and solicit, like, let me go make a $10 million film. You know, what can you do with nothing? you know?
Right. And in today's world, like when you and I were coming up, man, like it was expensive as hell to do anything. Like you shot on film, like that $7,000 was film stock.
iPhone 12 has got a better camera than any film or video camera we've ever used in our lives and can approximate, what is it, an 8K, whatever the fuck. It's 8K. Insane. That is insane, dude. That is lossless. Like you could like, we had to go like, oh shit, you got to go beta cam, beta SP to beta. Oh, there's a generational loss. And you had to deal with that shit.
3/4 inch, 1 inch, 3/4 inch.
Just to get the film flicker. I can do that on a fucking, on a filter, you know, color. Give me a break, dude. You know, it's like, this is the kind of shit that's at your fingertips. So it's like, I tell you something, stop dicking around on Twitter and basically like, go and examine and explore these things because they're amazing, you know, and you can really do great shit for no money.
The key isn't the whatchamacallit, the barrier of entry is not the tech anymore and the cost of the tech. It is the how to make money with it, how to get it seen.
Not only that, but it's also the creative gumption and ambition that you
there's that
to get it, because you know what? You may not make a fucking dime and you've got to come to grips with that. And you've got to say, okay, that's the possibility. How bad do you want it? That question remains. That question persists.
Brother, it has been a pleasure. Keep doing what you're doing. And absolutely, I appreciate I appreciate you, man.
Thank you so much, brother.
I want to thank Joe for coming on the show and dropping his bullet-ridden knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Joe. If you want to check out his new film, Boss Level, it's going to be available March 5th, exclusively on Hulu. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/443. And guys, if you haven't already, head over to ifhacademy.com and check out the amazing new courses we have on the platform, including James V. Hart's Screenwriting Masterclass, The Film Distribution Blueprint by yours truly, and many, many more. Again, that's ifhacademy.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.